I am joined by Ben Eifert, founder and chief investment officer of QVR Advisors. Ben, great to have you on Forward Guidance.
Hey, great to be here. Thanks.
I'm glad you could make it, Ben. You are an expert on options and all things volatility. Can you just give us a little bit of a background about what QV Advisors is, what sort of products you trade, and why?
Sure. So QVR is what you would think of as a boutique hedge fund business. There are a couple different parts to the business. One piece is the absolute return hedge fund strategies across a variety of different structures, but there the objective is to generate uncorrelated returns that aren't driven by the same risk factors that investors typically have exposure to, in particular, monetizing dislocations in derivatives markets on a market neutral basis. You know, market up or market down doesn't matter too much. The other part of the business is what we would call a solutions business. There we use our infrastructure and skills and capabilities in derivatives markets to solve problems that big asset owners have on a much more customized basis. Often that has to do with things like tail hedging, where we'll work with some very large endowment, for example, on structuring and managing a bespoke fund for them that's designed to solve the problem for them.
So when you say derivative products, how much of that is options versus more complicated structures, as well as, you know, exotic options that most people, including this, watching this, including myself, have no idea what they are?
Sure. So these days we trade primarily listed liquid options and futures. That is somewhat new at QVR relative to my prior history. So for most of the history of derivatives markets, hedge funds, including us, were involved in a lot of OTC products and traded bilaterally with banks and traded variance swaps and volatility swaps and all manner of things. The market really did start to change in the wake of the credit crisis of 2008, when really the Fed took the view, arguably correctly, that systemically risky institutions in financial markets like banks were taking far too much risk themselves, trading complex, opaque derivatives and creating vulnerabilities in the financial system. And regulators wanted banks to do a lot less of that, to hold a lot less risk, take a lot less risk. And as a result, a lot of liquidity in certain parts of derivatives markets really moved towards exchanges. So when you think today of the breadth of market activity in on U.S. option exchanges electronically, both among retail investors more recently and institutional investors over the last 10 years, has really been a huge explosion. And that's generally been a good thing. We've embraced that at QBR.
I've just got a question. So when I think of sort of the nuclear bomb in the 2008 Great Financial Crisis, I think of subprime CDOs as well as credit default swaps on those. But there, of course, there's a panoply of complicated, what I would consider complicated, derivatives like variance swaps that on the face of them are not related to credit default swaps on CDOs. So to what degree was the regulation that came after the Great Financial Crisis directed towards those types of exotic derivatives that may not have been at the sort of the scene of the crime of the blow up of the banks? Or were they at the scene of the crime?
Changes in the regulatory environment following 2008, which, by the way, mostly were implemented much later. So it was, think of the implementation of Dodd-Frank and later and Basel III really as being a mid-2010s thing, largely 2014, 2015, 2016. Those changes were pretty broad-based. They were not targeted specifically like at mortgage derivatives only. They were really addressing banks' ability to take risk and have risk exposure and the possibility of large-scale loss across a wide variety of product categories. And so what you see today, again, it's not that there is not activity in OTC derivatives. There certainly is. But the percentage of overall derivatives market activity represented by exotic OTC derivatives is much smaller today than it was, say, 15 or 20 years ago. And the percentage represented by listed options within the equity category, for example, is much, much larger.
Okay, so exotic bank OTC over-the-counter derivatives, that is a much smaller environment than it used to be. So now folks like yourselves trade a lot more in listed options. I know that there's been a proliferation of retail purchases of options, calls, and puts on single stocks, I guess perhaps equity indices as well. To what degree has that defined the derivatives environment? And has that increased volatility? Has it decreased it? Has it made it more attractive to be a market maker? And then also perhaps later we can get into the retail call options, at least volumes, which have been falling this year, right?
Yeah. So retail as a whole, I think you would think of most of the last 20 years, retail having been really quite quiet and not very involved in day trading and aggressive speculation. That really dating back to, I think, after the tech bust back in 2002, 2003, retail investors lost so much money and got so disheartened. And then again in 2008. 2019 was really the beginning of the change of that. I think you started to see a lot of brokerages moving to zero commission, at least zero headline commission rates, first on stocks and then on options. And you saw the growth of widespread social media communities focused on trading and investing and speculating. And so it moved beyond even just a personal thing and became like a social thing and a fun thing. And you really did see a huge explosion in retail activity in general. And then specifically, as you pointed out, in option trading, options are much simpler than OTC exotic derivatives, but still they're complicated to understand how much risk you're taking and how things might go from an individual trader's perspective. Among other things, you did see single name, short dated call option volumes really accelerate spectacularly. That was often associated with the subreddit called Wall Street Bets initially, and then became much broader than that. But you had a widespread group of retail investors that realized that they could get a lot of leverage by buying short dated options and also kind of positive asymmetry or positive convexity, where they could, if things went well, make a lot of money relative to the amount of money that they were risking. And so I think those features really made it very attractive. And through a period of time where markets were rallying, and then into the pandemic where markets sold off aggressively very briefly and then turned around and again off to the races, that type of behavior of just constantly going out and buying these leveraged positions and short dated options worked very well for that crowd of retail investors. I think, as you alluded to, the last 6 months we've had kind of a choppy down market, and so that's really burned a lot of that community, and you've seen volumes falling off. But that was really a phase shift in markets in terms of just this huge explosion of activity and volume in options and the composition of participants. And I think, from a market maker perspective, market makers, I think, lost a bit of money initially when retail started buying Tesla and driving Tesla through the roof. But then market makers adapted to, okay, this is how the game works now. And this is a new set of participants. How do they behave? How do we adapt to what we did? And, I think generally speaking, option market makers have been extremely successful over the last couple of years in monetizing that. That's usually who wins in the end, right? I think in most aggressive speculation and complicated instruments usually leads to losses among the people that are doing it. And, the gains are at the brokers and the exchanges and the market makers.
So if 2020 and 2021 saw a proliferation of single stock option calls, and calls can sort of be a self-fulfilling prophecy, a tail wagging the dog, because dealers, as it goes up, they have to hedge more and more. To what degree do you get that on the put side when, if someone buys a put struck at 60 and the stock's at 100, can you have those also, the gamma hedging on the way down as well? And perhaps to what degree is that responsible for some of the vicious sell-offs we've seen in single stocks this year?
Yeah, so that's right. So the gamma of an option and the way in which a dealer hedges it doesn't actually depend on whether it's a put or a call. It just depends on the strike price and where the underlying stock price is as compared to the strike price. And so when you think about the example, even first, let's just start with call buying, of where there's a big crew of people buying Tesla calls, for example, short dated. And maybe they're buying 10% out of the money, 2-week calls, and then those calls are initially what we would call 10 delta calls. They have 10% the sensitivity to the stock price of Tesla that a share of Tesla does, because they're pretty far out of the money and they'll probably expire out of the money from a, you know, probability perspective ex ante. When the dealers or market makers sell those calls to the buyers, they have to hedge them. They will buy that much delta to 10% of the notional of the options. Now, if Tesla rallies and rallies and rallies, and now actually those calls aren't 10 delta anymore, they're at the money, they're 50 delta. Now the dealers will have increased their long hedge by a factor of 5. They will have bought 5 times more stock just to stay neutral in that position to the underlying exposure to those positions. And but then if some exogenous event happens, there's some bad headline or Elon posts some really dumb meme on Twitter and nobody likes it, and then Twitter and then Tesla goes down 5%, then all of a sudden the delta on those calls will fall from 50 back to 25. And now the market makers have to go out and sell a whole bunch, right? And so gamma is really not a directional factor. It's really an accelerant, right? If the short dated option buying activity of retail investors or anyone, hedge funds, puts dynamic hedgers, market makers into a significantly short gamma position, then that effectively accelerates or amplifies price action in whatever direction the pressure is. And so, you know, to your point, if people are buying downside puts, as stocks are falling, that will amplify price momentum in that direction.
But it does depend on to what degree the dealer community is long or short gamma. So there's a perception, and I'm curious if you think it's accurate, that let's say in equity indices, you know, SPY, there's a lot of call overwriting. So investors, pension funds will sell calls, will be sellers of calls and buyers of puts, meaning that dealers will be buyers of calls and sellers of puts. So they'll be short gamma for puts on the way down, but they'll be long gamma on the way up. Is that in any way accurate? And then does that also change for single stocks?
Maybe very, very roughly directionally correct on average over long periods of time. But, you know, very not true a lot of the time, and, you know, a vast oversimplification, right? So right now, if anything, you know, dealer positioning is relatively the opposite. There's been very little demand for especially shorter dated puts. You know, market's been kind of grinding lower on relatively low volatility and bouncing back. People who have, if you had been trying to buy a lot of puts and really hedge a portfolio short term, that really didn't work and you burned a lot of premium, right? Dealers are, if anything, pretty long to the downside. And, you know, people are trying to buy calls on the upside and, you know, bet on or protect themselves against, if they're underweight, a rally back, a bear market rally or whatever it is, right? And you see that in skew. Skew is quite low right now. Upside is historically expensive relative to downside. And when the market moves down, vol really underperforms. When the market moves up, vol really outperforms. Everything is very consistent with exactly the opposite of that kind of stylized example that you gave in the current market environment.
That's fascinating. And to what degree is the fact that dealers are long put options because there's a low demand for put options from investors and pension funds, to what degree does that make sense given the realized volatility? Because the S&P 500 has drawdown year to date something like 14%. And you know, typically when you have a sell-off, the VIX spikes, volatility spikes. So can you just explain, does it make sense that the VIX is, I don't know, at 23 or 24 right now, given that the sell-off we've had?
Sure. I mean, the VIX is very short-term implied volatility, right? And I think people, you know, Cboe did a good job of making it this famous brand of kind of this benchmark fear index thing, right? And I think non-specialists really think of VIX in very generic terms as it's like volatility. It's very short-dated variance, right? So if the market is, you know, if VIX was 60 and realized vol was 15, then it would be like a ATM machine just printing money for anybody willing to sell options, and then the VIX would go down because people would sell options, right? Ultimately, the VIX over very short periods of time will move with the concerns of the investment community or whatever it is, right? But generally speaking, it's short-term implied volatility. It's going to move higher if the market's selling off in a big way. We're having 8% moves, we're having 6% moves. We're not, right? This is a relatively quiet index market environment. We've sold off we've had a modest index correction in the S&P on modest realized volatility. There's no reason why the VIX should be super high, right? I mean, VIX exceeded 80 in March of 2020 because we sold off 35% in 3 weeks with 12% crash days, right? Just an order of magnitude different environment than we're in now. So realized has been kind of low to mid 20s in this recent regime, and it's coming down significantly right now. So again, it depends on exactly the horizon that you're looking at. So VIX is forward looking, right? So generally speaking, if the market's getting quieter, it might decline faster than a trailing 30-day realized volatility, because the big move that happened a month ago will still be in that window, right? Generally speaking, right, the VIX is going to reflect the volatility environment that we're in addition to the pricing of skew and convexity. The VIX is technically a variance swap level, not an at-the-money vol level, so there's a premium of where VIX trades relative to like the vol of the at-the-money call or the at-the-money put. Right? The realized vol will tend to price where that at-the-money call or put is, and then kind of the price of convexity or tail risk will price where the VIX is relative to that.
And if that example you gave where realized volatility was 15 and the VIX was at 60, that would be a fantastic opportunity to sell volatility. If we say that's an extreme example of volatility being overpriced, on a historic basis, using something that maybe you can explain, like the volatility risk premium, are we at fair value, undervalued, or overvalued for the VIX at 23, 24?
I mean, we're much more in line from a historical perspective with where risk premiums are, right? So historically, let's talk long-term averages for a second, right? So historically, you might think long-term realized volatility in U.S. large cap equity index might be 16% or something like that. For at-the-money implied volatility relatively short-term, you might expect that to trade at a premium of a point and a half or 2 points over that. And then for a variance swap relative to at the money, given the fact that if you sell a variance swap, you're taking on much more negatively convex exposure to volatility. Historically, that might trade at like a 2 or 3 points premium to the at the money. And so you might get from, say, 16 realized, 18 at the money implied to a 20 or 21 VIX range. And that might be like a very long term average world, right? If anything, actually realized vol, it's very regime dependent, right? So you'll go years with lower or higher than that. But that's a broad brush strokes, averages, right? And VIX right now is a bit higher than that. Realized vol has been a bit higher than that. The biggest thing making the VIX materially higher than that, very long term, is actually the fact that that premium of variance over at the money or VIX over at the money has been in a much higher range after COVID than it was, or after the March of 2020 specifically, than it was before. So the new range is, call it 4 to 7 points over VIX relative to a 1 month at the money vol. And that's really driven by there's a lack of sellers of variance. There used to be for a long time a lot of systematic and opportunistic sellers of short dated variance for income. That strategy is extremely risky because variance is massively negatively asymmetric. And March of 2020, variance sellers lost 25 years of gains. And so they all went away and stopped, and nobody will let anyone sell variance anymore. So that's why we've had this kind of reset higher in the price of tail risk and convexity. And that's reset the VIX somewhat higher relative to at the money and realized vol.
So that's VIX, which if I understand it, covers all sorts of the moneyness. It's not just at the money. What about specifically that left tail risk? How would you judge whether tail risk is underpriced, overpriced, or accurately priced before I even ask you what it is now? How would you go about making that determination?
I would loosely define tail risk as you know, as not, for example, implied volatility, the level of implied volatility or the level of some near the money thing, right? Tail risk really refers to those Armageddon events, you know, whether it be four standard deviations or five standard deviations or six standard deviations or whatever you want to talk about. That variance premium is actually an okay proxy is one okay proxy for tail risk, because a variance swap, again, is the P&L of a variance swap is proportional to the square of volatility, right? So you know, if you're short it, you lose a dollar. If, you know, vol is 20 maybe, but if vol is 40, you lose that, and you had a squared, you know, at a squared rate, right? So that your losses for 10 times higher volatility are 100 times bigger, right? So that's tail risk. And it's very hard to ever know if tail risk is really overpriced, right? Because there is some price of that tail risk. And if I'm talking about something that has sort of infinitely, exponentially worse P&L in a crazier situation, we're arguing about, well, is the probability of this really, really crazy thing 0.01% or is it 0.01000%? And none of us have any idea, right? Like, there's no resolution in, there's no information about the world that we have that tells us, is it sort of like this vanishingly small probability or three times bigger than that, right? And yet that should be reflected in three times difference in the price. Right? So, you know, you might have a tail risk selling strategy and just say, this is high relative to where we have seen it historically, and we're deciding to do this, and here's the potential loss, and people might sign up for that. But I think intellectually, honestly, saying, well, this is overpriced is very hard. Generally speaking, underpriced is kind of the opposite, where if there is a way to be long some unlikely but certainly possible event and long an exposure to that for almost no or no cost of carry, then clearly that's wildly underpriced, right? And I think in markets, you don't see that often, but you certainly see that happen, especially if you're clever about how you express and structure those kind of opportunities.
And would comparing the skew, i.e., you know, the implied volatility of that out of the money put relative to at the money volatility, would that be an accurate way to judge whether tail risk is cheap or expensive, or no, that's flawed?
It's really subtle and hard. So as a starting point, what is your calculation for skew? Were you looking at, you know, the 10 delta versus the 50 delta and normalizing by the 50 delta or not? Are you looking at it in moneyness terms? What does it really mean economically? I think that people get into trouble with that, where a lot of the kinds of calculations that you might do naively aren't really time stationary, aren't really independent of all, and are kind of hard to use. I tend to discourage, you know, non-specialists from really trying to think about or look at skew in any detail. You can think of just what is the level of vol of a, you know, of a five delta put or something is a much simpler, simpler thing, right? What does it mean that there's some different percentage difference between like the five delta put and the 25 delta put? And is that meaningful if they're all really low? I don't know, right? But if the five delta put is, you know, super low, then you know. Again, there's a difference between low and cheap. And I think this is like the most important thing ever in anything derivatives and volatility related is, you can't say like that thing is relatively low compared to where it used to be and therefore it's cheap, or that thing is relatively high and therefore that thing is expensive, right? Because markets set prices in all of these things based on what's going on in the market and relative to everything else in the market. And, you know, you really have to think in, I think, you know, much more nuanced ways. Now, you can think in pretty absolute ways if a particular tail, again, can be effectively bought for free or very nearly free, right? That's a much more absolute sense in which this thing is cheap. If an implied vol is, you know, two standard deviations below its long-term average, but the realized vol is like massively low and that probably won't change, that thing might actually be expensive.
Okay. Let's say I'm going to take an example of something you wrote on Twitter and take it to the extreme. By the way, people should definitely follow you on Twitter. You're at Ben D. Eifert with two N's. So let's say that for 2023, every single day, the S&P 500 sells off 1.5%. Literally every single trading day for the year. What are some examples of tail risk hedges that would perform spectacularly, and what are others that would not perform well at all?
Total. So, that was a fun question, right? And it's related to this environment of, you know, slow chop down in equity markets, right? So you just buy a put. That works great because the market just goes down and down and down. It actually goes down quite quickly over a meaningful enough period of time, right? So if you buy if that's going to happen every single day, you buy a 6-month, 30% of the money put, that's going to cost you almost nothing and it's going to make a massive amount of money. And that's very easy and very simple. What won't work, buying a VIX 60 call, right? People might be tempted to think like, oh, 30% of the money S&P put, 60 VIX call, these are both very wingy things, but they're in different spaces, right? One is in price space for equities. And if equities go down that much over any period of time, it doesn't matter before maturity, like you get paid on your put option. If you buy a VIX call, you have exposure to a massive spike in implied volatility. Why would there be a massive spike of implied volatility if the market just goes down 1.5% every single day? We might all get really scared and stuff, but again, if the market's only moving 1.5% a day, selling volatility, if implied volatility gets materially higher than say 25 or 30, is going to be extraordinarily profitable and people are going to sell a lot of volatility. You're never going to get to 60 because again, the profitability of selling volatility, if the market's only moving 1.5% a day and vol is 60, is going to be massively profitable to sell vol. So your VIX 60 calls will never get anywhere close.
Wow. So this is an example of, you said, yeah, folks who aren't in the derivative space, it's very challenging. So for me, down 1.5% every day. I just did it, Googled it. So 0.985 to the 20th power, because there are 20 trading days in a month, is like 73. So that's a 27% sell-off in a month, which to me sounds huge. But you're saying if it is 1.5% every single day, that is, even if it's a 27% decrease over a month sell-off, that the VIX will be low. So what is realized volatility if it's 1.5%?
1.5% a day is 24% realized vol.
Okay. So it's measured like every single day.
People will be scared and whatever, right? So like, where is VIX going to be? Was the point of that question? There's no exact answer. You don't know. It depends on a lot of things, right? But you're starting from 24 realized vol, right? So if you add a reasonable premium and then a variance premium, maybe you've gotten to 28 or 30, and then anything on top of that has to be just kind of pure excess risk premium that's coming from, people being scared and it's not being counterbalanced by enough selling, right? Because if vol is anywhere above 20, if at the money vol is anywhere above 24, you're going to make money selling it in that regime.
So, whereas 10% up on Monday, 10% down on Tuesday for an entire month, even though over the month it would get zero, that the VIX would be 160 there?
Yeah, realized vol would be 160 there.
Yeah. Okay.
And so VIX could be higher than that.
So Ben, now let's move on to the world of single stocks, where I'm of the belief that realized volatility, at least in some names, has been immense. Walmart, Target, Snapchat, just melting after earnings, as well as down 9% days on non-earning days. So what has the volatility world for single stocks looked like? Let's say for this year.
Yep. So that's totally been the story of this year, as you've said, right? Is quite high single name realized volatility, pretty high sector volatility, much more moderate index volatility, right? Lots of diversification and decorrelation and rotation under the hood. What are the drivers of that? I mean, there certainly have been continued ongoing fundamental drivers of sector factor type of realized volatility and factor rotation, right? So you think of, okay, what are the big macro stories that people are excited about? Inflation and interest rates. And rightly or wrongly, mostly rightly, I think people assign different sectors or different types of companies, big betas to those factors, right? It's like, okay, yields are going up a lot. What should happen? Tech should sell off. There's this idea that tech is like a long duration asset, right? You have a bunch of growth out in the future and you have to discount those cash flows very heavily versus like energy and materials and, cyclical stuff like that, where it's like, oh, great, inflation, but prices for the stuff is way up and it's super robust and you're going to, they're going to be able to get into new mines and dig new capacity at what used to be unprofitable. Now it's wildly profitable. And so that stuff's up, right? So when you have the big yields up and inflation scare day, what do you have? You have tech selling off. You have all that other stuff rallying, and at the index level, it's kind of netting out, right? And so I think that's part of it. And then another part of it, really, that you see in the earnings announcement moves and the sympathy moves that names have for other names on earnings announcement. And I think you have a combination of a continued ongoing relatively low liquidity environment, again, in terms of banks' ability to warehouse risk. And you have lots of crowded positioning in hedge funds. Hedge funds, long short equity hedge fund world has just gotten incredibly large. And people have very big positions on that they get stopped out of. You know, earnings come in poor, and so a pod at 0.72 gets tapped on the shoulder and has to sell their position in that name overnight into terrible liquidity just to get out. And so you see these huge swings. Yeah, you see Facebook moving 30% on earnings, you know, mega cap tech names moving like crazy. And, you know, that combination of factors, I think, is driving a very, very active landscape in single name volatility, plus amplified in some cases probably by complex option positioning in among the retail community and, you know, dealer short gamma positioning and so forth. So it's been a very fruitful landscape there. And again, a lot of that is averaging out to some extent at the index level and in some sense, you know, making us feel more calm than it really is.
So obviously a huge amount of realized volatility, someone's making money, but as someone who's trading the options, you know, specifically to get exposure to a first, second, or third order Greek, not specifically just the directional way the stock is going to go, what are the opportunities there? Because you said earlier that retail call options are going down. So if it's not that retail investors are paying, like, you know, perhaps a non-economic value for, they're overpaying for implied volatility, what's the opportunity?
Sure. So, I mean, in general, in single name volatility and index volatility, you know, folks like us. So, for example, we have what's called a dispersion strategy. Dispersion generally refers to trading volatility on the index versus volatility on the underlying components of the index and synthesizing an exposure that's related to correlation, to how correlated or decorrelated are the names in the index behaving. Certainly, there's been lots of good opportunities this year in dispersion where you've seen, again, very strong fundamentals for single name realized volatility in that underlying factor sector rotation, crazy earnings moves and so forth. You've also seen the indices, as we discussed, not really realizing that much volatility, a much healthier, more normal volatility risk premium in index as compared to the pre-COVID days when there was a lot more aggressive volatility selling, right? And so on average this year, the opportunity set really has been to be long single name volatility and short index volatility. Again, in different sizes, depending on how attractive that is at a moment in time with current pricing, right? But that's the kind of position where, you know, someone like us will be very dynamic. Sometimes the opportunity is the other way, to be long index volatility and short single name volatility. But in a market where, again, index isn't really realizing that well, is staying relatively bid because people are worried about Ukraine or because, you know, people are doing some hedging or demand or buying upside calls for that matter. And single names on the other hand are moving like crazy. That's a way that a manager like us, you know, participates in that kind of opportunity set.
How responsive are market makers to, let's say, Target and Walmart sell off hard? Suddenly they're increasing the implied volatility. They're making puts more expensive, the puts that they're selling. You know, I know that was a pretty successful strategy for market makers to just make GME calls more expensive. Are they making single stock volatility more expensive? Have you seen a rise in implied volatility for single stocks relative to the realized volatility?
So certainly single name, both realized and implied vol are higher in this environment than they are, than they would have been, say, in 2019, or by quite a lot, as one would expect. Think of, you know, market makers, depends on what you mean by set the price, right? I mean, market makers, that market makers do move the prices of options quickly in the very short term in response to flow, right? So you mentioned GME. Certainly one job of a market maker when you have kind of a big stampeding herd coming in to buy call options, right? I mean, the market makers got very dynamic about understanding when flow was coming and moving prices to accommodate, you know, accumulate the inventory they needed to hedge and all that kind of thing. But market makers don't really, in some sense, set where the price of like average S&P 500 single name volatility is, right? I mean, supply and demand sets that price, right? Who are the buyers? Who are the sellers? And what's the balance and what's the realized volatility delivering? And therefore, what's the buying pressure or the selling pressure? And so really, you know, the market participants there, obviously there's retail and what, you know, how much demand do they have for different kinds of options. There's, you know, big institutions doing hedging. You know, hedge funds are big users of options, even directional hedge funds that are primarily long short, primarily trying to express views on stocks, are heavy users of options to shape the payoff distribution and the time horizon that they're looking for in a stock, right? They might not buy the stock. They might buy a 3-month call spread, or they might buy, if they have an earnings view, they might buy a call just, you know, very short dated right after earnings or you know, all these kind of things, right? So that, and then you'll have, of course, yield harvesting type of people who want to sell volatility because they think it's overpriced in general. And it's that balance of supply and demand that really sets where does vol trade. And yeah, vols on single names is you know, trading materially higher than it did in the quieter days of the pre-pandemic times.
I was reading a report from QBR, your firm, where you referred to your trading process as something like a one-sided market maker. I didn't really understand that. Could you explain that a little bit?
Sure. And really, that's referring to trade execution. So when you think about the market environment that we're in, really, the last several years, I think what I would characterize liquidity as exceptionally good for anyone who is participating passively in the volume of the market and accumulating inventory, but excessively bad for any market participant that is withdrawing liquidity aggressively from the marketplace by requiring a capital commitment trade, asking a market maker or a bank for a price in some big size to commit to. Right.
Sorry. Why is that? And could you just explain that? Break it down a little bit. Yeah.
Sure. Absolutely. So volumes in the market are very large in equity options, let's say in the US, right? And because there's a lot of volume, if one is interacting with that volume in the way that a market maker does, simply by being out in the market, being the best bid in the market for everything that you want to buy and being the best offer in the market for everything that you want to sell, and there's all kinds of different market participants coming in and buying and selling all kinds of stuff, right? Then you are able to accumulate inventory that you want at mid-market or better than mid-market, you know, very easily, you know, steadily over time, right? But there are no, right, banks don't have risk-taking capability anymore. So you can't call a bank and say, I need a price in $10 billion of notional of this big trade and expect to get a tight market and be able to get done, right? That's the point. And in the old days, everybody used to trade like the latter, because why would you like deal with all of this complicated stuff of like trading lots of options electronically and coding robots and all this stuff? If you just call a bank, and banks deal with that. You just call a bank, you call five banks, you get the best price and you execute that, right? But that's what's changed in the market, right? So there are still people that try to trade like that, that have no other option, that don't have other capabilities. But liquidity for large liquidity withdrawing trades requiring capital commitment from banks and counterparties is very poor. That's the point. So when we have risk that we want, we're representing our interest looking like a market maker, but only on one side of the market. That's what I mean. So if there's these 5,000 options we want to buy, maybe we're adding to a dispersion strategy, and these are all the single name options that we want to buy, and then here's the index options that we want to sell, we will be best bid in the market dynamically in high frequency, you know, ahead of the market makers for all those options we're trying to buy, and we will be the best offer in the market ahead of the market makers in everything that we want to sell. But we won't be on the other side also. We won't be making a market bid and ask, because that's not our job. We're not market makers. We're just trying to get into positions or get out.
Right. So you express a ton of, I guess you could say, limit orders for a ton of securities that you will only get filled on some of them. That's different than you sort of calling up your trader and being like, you know what, I see Walmart's, they're reporting their earnings tonight. Like, let's buy some calls. Puts, I should say. Yeah.
Right, because the stocks only go down now. Yeah, that's right. I mean, an order, I mean, gets into the weeds, right? But like, the way that an order is going to be represented in the market, even if we want to buy 10,000 of these, you know, particular options, there's only going to be a few of those out in the market at once on the bid, and it's going to be, you know, canceling and replacing the price, the limit price, you know, potentially at like the millisecond frequency or whatever as the market's moving, and being designed to just slowly chisel into that position at mid-market or better.
Ben, if I think about sort of the pyramid of assets, where it's treasuries, no credit risk bonds, then credit, and then equities, and then maybe level four is crypto, I don't know. I feel like so much of what we talked about so far is level three, equities, and then indices, which have, you know, baskets of single name equities in them. How much are you paying attention to layer one of interest rate volatility, like the move index of the short end, and that, you know, that leads us to my favorite topic, macro, as well as credit volatility, which I feel like it's extremely important, but I don't hear a lot of people talking about credit and vol. And I can't even give you an index like the VIX or the move for credit. So yeah, what about treasuries and credit?
Yep. So credit vol is a meaningful market, but it's nowhere near as big as markets in equity vol or in rates vol. So there aren't you know, VIX style indices in credit. You would look at typically at the price of the normal implied vol of swaptions on the IG or high yield indices that you could pull up on Bloomberg. Generally, those trade fairly short dated. They tend to be like with anything, there's risk premium sellers that are trying to earn some yield, and then there's hedgers who are trying to buy. More recently, you've seen a lot of flow in some of the major ETFs. So a typical credit account for hedging purposes might be a put buyer or a put spread buyer in HYG, for example, which is the your typical most liquid high yield credit ETF. On the rate side, again, yeah, we don't really pay attention to the move index because it's not it's not a thing that is tradable and is interesting, right? But it's what, you know, you can kind of what they'll show on CNBC. But we'll certainly think about where at the front end of the curve, right? You have Treasury futures options and you have Euro dollar options, and so, you know, those vols, along with the longer dated swaption implied vols that you would see are very high. They've started to come back down a little bit, but they actually got to 2008 type of levels, about as high as they ever are in history, about a month ago. You think of the size of the rate. This is really the biggest fixed income sell-off, the biggest fastest sell-off, fixed income sell-off in history, pretty much. I mean, it exceeded the size of the 94. Moves certainly in losses on duration and also in moves across the yield curve, right? So, and it wasn't necessarily one that had, you know, insane single day moves, although we had a lot of big ones. Also, it just had a huge trend and you know, it liquidated lots and lots and lots of the typical sellers of volatility at the short end of the curve in rates. And so you're kind of, I think, slowly now starting to see some normalization there as the yield move kind of slowed down and realized volatility in rates has come back off a little bit. This is really the first time in several years that there's been a sustained material phase shift in macro volatility. So in rates volatility, currency volatility. And that really came from certainly those vols spiked in March of 2020 because everything was spiking and everything was crashing, but that was a very brief event and it wasn't really a macro driven event. I mean, the pandemic is macro in a way, right? But it didn't have interest rate drivers. It didn't have currency drivers, right? Versus this last 6 months, there's a lot of different things going on, but it's very caught up in this narrative around accelerating inflation, dramatically accelerating inflation, the Fed response to that, where yields and interest rates are going to go, what's going to happen to currency as a result, right? It's had much more of a core macro driver. And that's been reflected in some of the highest, you know, macro volatility that we've seen, again, since 2008.
And to what degree do you think that macro volatility, particularly I'm thinking of the huge spike in short-term rates, is driving volatility in equity markets? You know, the narrative is, and I actually do tend to believe it, that yeah, you know, the 2 year having gone from 50 basis points to 250 basis points, that has something to do with, you know, ARKK selling off huge and XLE going up. I'm talking pure delta here, but does it have anything to do with the implied volatility of ARKK or XLE, or is that something that you think is kind of overhyped in its relevance?
I mean, vol follows moves in stock. Vol is about kind of what the underlying spot price has done and is likely to do, and what are people worried about, right? I don't think there aren't really strong first order cross asset vol linkages in the sense that, like, if equity vol goes up, rates vol has to go up, or vice versa, right? They are very different markets, and there's lots of examples historically of, you know, big disconnections between the two. Often, because, like, think back to 2018, you know, we had some material equity market volatility in February of 2018 and again in December of 2018, and nothing macro cared at all, and people kind of scratched their heads, but it's like, this was just a technical weird squeeze in equity markets and a re-rating, a temporary re-rating of equity multiples, and why does that have to have anything to do with other vol? There aren't, you know, there you would see some hedge funds doing things like selling equity vol and buying treasury vol or something like that. But again, because the correlation is so low, there's not a strong transmission mechanism there where if one gets too high, people will sell it and buy the other one. That works with things that are 90% correlated, right? Not with things that are sort of 40% correlated. So I think it's more the latter, right? Where I tend to believe at least part of the narrative, right? I think similar to you, that big fast moves up in rates spooked a lot of investors in equities and risk assets, you know, especially tech investors. And that was one of the reasons why we saw a lot of selling of tech. Another reason was just that tech had massively gone up for arguably no particularly good reason the year or two before, especially, and not just tech as a whole, especially the more like speculative, unprofitable tech. There's the number of price charts that you look at, right, that just like massively rocket shipped, went up 5x in a year or two, and then have then come right back down. Sort of every chart looks the same within that space. And so, interest rates probably helped catalyze that unwind, but the unwind kind of needed to happen because they went up because Tiger bought all that stuff in massive size, not because there was a good reason for them to go up.
To what degree does Rho play a role? A Greek that's a change, exposure of an option relative to the change in interest rates. If we've had a huge spike in interest rates, historic by your own account, does that change, is that something that's big enough to actually make a difference in option markets, or no?
I mean, in general, no. The option market doesn't hold in the aggregate like lots and lots and lots of real risk. You could, in any one given investor's portfolio, I think if you found a hedge fund that had a big complicated option portfolio and wasn't thinking about their interest rate exposure and wasn't managing it, like they may have lost a percentage point or two accidentally, or made a percentage point or two accidentally. But I think that's pretty unusual. I mean, I think for the most part, in the aggregate, that's a very small exposure in options markets as compared to the more primary types of factors that we would think of.
Now let's return to the topic of sort of the tail wagging the dog. What is options expiry? In what ways does it result in huge moves, either in the index or individual stocks? And then also, if the expiry is on Friday, does the move, the realized move, does it happen on the Friday? Does it happen on the Monday, on the Thursday? What's going on here? Because I know I saw Chris Siddle say that we have a huge June OPEX coming up. So tell us about what's going on here.
Sure. So, you know, options expiration is just the regular periodic expiration of options. You think of there's monthly expiration, and then there's somewhat bigger quarterly expirations where you have the monthlies rolling off and also quarterlies. The thing that is a little interesting about expiration is, so when you think about an option, the dynamism of that option in the sense of how fast its risk exposures change as the underlying price changes. For a very long dated option, it's very non-dynamic. For a very short dated option that's about to expire, if the underlying stock price, we'll talk about stocks, it's the same for anything, right, is pretty close to the strike and the option is very close to expiration, that's an extremely dynamic risk position where just think for a second about, you know, a call option that's expiring later that day and it's maybe that call option is currently in the money by 50 basis points and you're kind of expecting to end up in the money and to get stock. But then if all it takes is a 1% sell-off, and now all of a sudden you're an equal amount out of the money, and if you've only got a couple hours left, you know, the delta could be swinging from 90 to 10, and you could be having to aggressively rehedge if you're short that option or long that option, right? And so that's the interesting characteristic of expiration, is you have lots and lots and lots of random option positions that dynamic hedgers, market makers, volatility arbitrage managers might need to hedge in different ways, kind of aggressively and, you know, maybe unexpectedly, based on what happens to stocks, right? And so the really option expiration is a priori things could be weird, but like you really don't have a lot of information as an outsider or even as a fairly informed insider about what all those things are, right? Because it depends entirely on how lots of different people are positioned. You'll see people make naive comments about the size of expiration or about the impact by looking at open interest or something, but that doesn't tell you anything, right? Because, or it maybe tells you directionally a little bit of something, but you know, if there's 10,000 lots of SPX on the expiring, you know, 3,500 strike, you don't know who holds that, if they're a dynamic hedger or not, if it actually even is meaningful in the sense that there might be 10,000 calls and 10,000 puts, and the same dealer holds a long position in one and a short position in the other, and there's actually no optionality on that line, right? And you don't know any of that. So the net positioning of dynamic hedgers and what kind of weird positions they might have and how stocks might move can generate really interesting outcomes. I think that lots of people read way too much ex ante into things, and then you see a lot of ex post rationalizations, but they may or may not be right. If you really happen to understand very well, for a variety of reasons, that you know the street is really, really short gamma on this particular expiration right at 4,000, and you're pretty confident in that, then that gives you some information. And you know, there are obviously folks that spend a lot of time on how to come to that conclusion, be confident in that. But I think it's tough to just look at open interest and have a lot, read a lot into like what the implications are.
What about folks or strategies who talk about gamma walls that say, oh, the street is long an incredibly large amount of gamma at 3750 and their short gamma lower point, therefore X is going to happen for Y reason. Is that sort of just the, you know, derivatives, you know, version of resistance for people looking at trading charts, or is there something there?
Well, there can be, right? The question is, you know, how do you know that? And you might actually know that. So sometimes, for example, there are very large mutual funds, you know, that we don't need to name or whatever, but that like will have a known position, and it's a giant position, and you can see it, and you know exactly who holds the other side of that position and whether they're long or short and what hedging they will need to do with respect specifically to that position. Now it gets complicated because they no doubt have hedges and you don't know where those hedges are and how, you know, whatever, right? But they may not be expiring and they may not be really nearby. So again, if you have a really good understanding of the picture and where it comes from, then that can be a real thing, right? Because if you know, if I'm a bank and I have a massive position and I'm long options 25 basis points above where the S&P is now, and the S&P's, you know, trying to rally, like I'm going to be hedging and hedging and hedging and creating pressure and resistance there, right? So, but again, it all just comes back to like, is this kind of general speculation from open interest, or is this like there's a good reason why we understand where this positioning is and where it comes from?
Ben, what would you say are some of the greatest mistakes that retail traders make? And I'd even include hedge funds in retail because they're not, you know, not necessarily volatility experts. And then what are the greatest mistakes that volatility pros such as yourself, you find them making?
So I would say a few things. I mean, I think on the retail side, you do see historically there's always been a lot of effort to sell retail investors option selling strategies one way or another. And that's true, I think, among the older generation of retail investors. And it's more newly true with a lot of the Reddit crowd. So you think of like Theta Gang on Reddit is all about this. And I think generally There isn't anything inherently wrong with selling options, but usually there's a very misleading narrative about what you're doing and why might it work or why might not it work. So in particular, you'll hear things like, well, if you like this stock at $50, but it's trading at 55 and you kind of wish you could buy it at 50, what you should do is sell a put at 50. And then it's like you're getting paid to buy the stock at 50, and it's kind of like almost free money, or it's like too good to be true or whatever. You know, that's ridiculous, because, well, what if the option is only 5 cents and there's a relatively large probability that you hit earnings and it gaps down to 45 or something, right? So now you've, and in which case that option is going to be worth $3 and you just lost a massive multiple of the maximum that you ever hoped to gain, right? So my point there is just anytime you buy or sell an option, you have to be thinking about what is the possible payoff. You have to think about probabilities a little bit, because options are very asymmetric. So it sort of depends what probability is that things move, and how much you're getting paid for it, or if you're selling it, or how much you're paying, and is that reasonable, right? And that might be a difficult calculus to do, but you can't just ignore any of that calculus and think this is free money. It's sort of, I'm selling, I'm getting to buy this stock at 50 if it goes down. And I'm getting paid for that, right? So, I talk a lot about that kind of stuff. I think you have to really understand the economics of the transaction that you're doing and why it might make sense. Among more professional types, I mean, I think that the obvious area there is that, you know, markets are pretty competitive and not nearly as inefficient in a direct sense as people give them credit for a lot of the time. And, you know, it's tough to make money. And what often happens over time is that during quiet markets or during easy times, right, professional derivatives traders and volatility traders will get sucked into selling tail risk and doing sneaky things to make a little bit of extra money, right? Because they get paid for it and makes them feel good, makes them feel smart, and the bad thing probably won't happen. And that always ends the same way, which is that, you know, once every 5 years or 10 years or however many years it is, like that crazy thing happens that, you know, they didn't think was likely to happen, and they blow up spectacularly. And often their investors didn't know that they were, you know, doing that kind of tail risk selling or whatever it is. Right. And I think it's a tough psychological, you know, thing to resist. Obviously, you see it. I think that, you know, investors need good to become equipped with good questions to ask to validate and verify that managers aren't sneakily selling tails. But I think that that's really the obvious thing that you do just see. You see a lot of people fall into over time.
I want to talk about if someone were to buy an option and let's say the bid is 250 and the ask is 290, obviously a bad thing to do is just buy it at the market and then you'll buy it at 290. You probably would want to put it out at 270 or 250 and then you'll get a better price. But even if they get it at 250, let's say, and they're buying that with an implied volatility of 60, that could still be a bad trade if the true price of implied volatility should be 30. How should people think about that? Maybe how should retail traders think about that? And then how do you think about it where you don't have a fundamental view on the stock necessarily? Like, what are you using to price it in? Historical realized volatility, historical realized volatility of other things. I know I gave you a lot.
Sure. So as an individual investor, I think, first of all, you should have a pretty high bar to using options in the first place, because it just raises lots of, usually individual investors are busy. They have day jobs, they have families, they have stuff. And there's just a lot that can go wrong with options, right? If you're really thinking about using options, even thinking about vol as a starting point is probably not necessarily you don't ever want to do that, but that should be like the seventh thing that you think about, right? The first thing that you're thinking about is what the payoff profile of that position is, what the time horizon is, how that relates to your view, how that relates to what your upside is and what your downside is and whether you think that makes sense, right? And, you know, when you think about, you know, buying short-dated options on some meme stock, it's very hard to know. Like, there is no such thing as a fair vol in some, like, theoretical sense, right? There's just a meme. What is this meme stock going to do? I don't know. It could go up 200% tomorrow. tomorrow. It could like do all kinds of things. Like what you have to think about is, what is the bet that you're making? What's the payoff profile of that bet? What's the downside? What's the upside? What are the reasonable range of scenarios and kind of probabilities in some kind of sense? And why are you kind of doing this? And again, probably a bad idea trading options on meme stocks. But I think thinking about things in very simple price and payoff and probability world makes much, much more sense than anything else. I think for us, there's all kinds of different volatility traders in the world. We're not like sitting around here looking at different options and being like, well, I think that option should be 24 vol, but it's actually 25 vol, so we're going to buy it. Like our workflow is very, very different. The starting point for everything that we do is, recurring strategy themes where there's some particular type of dislocation that we understand really well, that we have models of, that we have a whole like research infrastructure for, and understanding what kind of a trade we would put on around that kind of dislocation that's hedged in a particular kind of way and market neutral and so forth. So we have no idea if like that option over there should be 24 vol or 25 vol or 26 vol or whatever.
But the model that you create does have a view. You don't have a view.
On the vol of an option.
Okay, so what's the model's view then?
Completely. We run a bunch of different strategies and they're all very specific and none of them involve having a particular view on the vol of a 3-month Tesla option or whatever.
Interesting. Well, Ben, as we reach a close, can I ask you, because I know you're someone, you're very in the weeds on volatility, options, convexity. And I think you're someone who You may, based on your Twitter, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, you may think there's a little bit too much macro tourism about people saying rates are going to go negative, rates are going to spike to 10%. You got to double down, buy tons of crypto, sell tons of stock, buy tons of stock. So number one, is it even appropriate for me to ask you about your macro views? And number two, if I can, what are your macro views?
I don't really have macro views, so we don't, it's not really part of the process in any kind of offensive sense. The way that I mostly relate to and think about macro, is from a defensive perspective. So thinking about, when you think about dislocations in derivatives markets and how they manifest, sometimes what's really a macro structural change can look to the naive observer like a dislocation in derivatives markets. So I'll give you some examples. Weird derivatives nerds think about skew and, the price of upside vol versus downside vol. And we think about the different things that affect skew in derivatives world. In 2012, Nikkei skew, which, so the Nikkei index in Japan is an equity index. It normally would have your typical inverted skew where puts trade at a higher vol, downside strikes, puts trade at a higher vol than upside strike calls, flattened and flattened and flattened, and then fully inverted where upside calls traded at a meaningfully higher vol than downside puts. And there were lots of derivatives people who didn't think much about macro who just said, well, this is silly. XYZ reasons or why this is, and let's sell some calls and buy some puts on a ratio and have some kind of a trade that bets that this is going to go away. Well, the reason that was happening was because the Nikkei had been totally stagnant for decades after Japan's bubble burst and recession, and Shinzo Abe was proposing like all of these very dramatic market reforms and aggressive central bank action and all kinds of stuff. And like macro investors were coming into the market and buying tons of upside calls because they thought the Nikkei could like double or triple on the back of that. And it did, right? So you had a massively volatile, explosive move up, and anybody that was like selling down upside calls to buy downside puts just got totally destroyed, right? And the point is that was a macro structural theme that was manifesting itself in derivatives markets through a derivatives markets price. And you had to know that. You have to be able to think about derivatives markets dislocations and things that look like derivatives markets dislocations and understand where they're coming from. What kind of flow is driving it? Is it price insensitive customer flow? Is it directional customer flow, but not really like informed on vol? Or is it like, smart macro people betting on a state of the world that you don't want to just be short on the other side of the trade from them? And that's how we interact with macro, right? The view, the way of approaching the world where you just, you have 10 things you think about the world and then all the trades that you have on because of that, is obviously that's what macro investors do. And, you know, macro investors can be very smart. It's a very different workflow. It's not something you can do naively, right? Because like lots of people think things about the world and like, you don't necessarily know, even if you're right about this thing that you think, is the trade that you have on going to work? Well, it depends on how it's priced, incorporating what expectations about what's going to happen then, where you see that all the time with like, are rates going to go up or down if CPI comes in at X level or whatever, right? It's like, oh, like CPI beat Wall Street expectations, but you know, implied inflation is down. It's because, well, implied inflation was pricing in a bigger beat. And like, you know, so anyway, that's a very different workflow. That's a very different approach. There are lots of, you know, there's macro managers out there that do that kind of thing.
Right.
We approach macro, again, more from a defensive perspective.
But do your models or some volatility managers' models incorporate events thing? If, oh, Jay Powell, you know, next week is FOMC, perhaps vols across the board should be a little bit higher. Friday is CPI, perhaps vols a little higher. Oh, there are no Fed speakers that's doing anything, maybe vols a little lower. Is that something that you think about or no?
Yeah, that's very typical. So you have, you know, volatility variance arrival calendars that know the various known catalysts and know the various impacts that those, you know, might have on term structure shapes and so forth.
Got it. Well, Ben, my final question for you is, does the VIX have to spike for the S&P 500 to bottom? Earlier in our conversation, you mentioned that if anything, dealers are actually long puts because demand for puts on the S&P 500 is not that high from users of options. Does there have to be fear in the market and for people to buy a lot of puts for there to be an S&P 500 bottom, or is that kind of a myth?
I mean, there's certainly don't have to have volatility spikes coinciding with market bottoms. They generally don't, right? There's no evidence for that at all. Look at March of 2020, which was a classic crash, right? Vol spiked. The peak of volatility was 2 days before the peak of the trough of the market. The last two down days in the S&P were a down 4% day and a down 2.5% day. I think both of those days volatility collapsed, like in a big way, on both of those, you know, large down days in the market, because there had already been a big series of liquidations the prior day that reset volatility to crazy levels, right? So volatility and market are just two different related things. They're not the same thing. Same with, if you think back to 2008, peak volatility was really hit in Q4 of 2008, right? Associated with the massive market swings with fear of banks going under and all this sort of stuff. The market didn't bottom until March of 2009. But volatility had fallen, you know, pretty significantly at that point. Credit spreads had tightened and credit markets had started to normalize, you know, but equity investors were still panicking and selling out of their positions. So again, there's absolutely no reason to think or no evidence that would suggest that you have to have, you know, that a big VIX spike will tell you when the market has bottomed.
Right. Thanks. I want to actually refine my question, which is, do we need a VIX 250, 60, 70, 80? For there to be a bottom, not so much as soon as you have that VIX spike, by S&P because it's bottomed. And also, how do you even know what's the top of the spike? Which you also have pointed that earlier in your research report. So you know.
Yeah. I mean, there's just no relationship between these things, right? Like, there's no. Why would you need a VIX to hit some particular high number? Stocks can go down in a grind down where people are just selling stocks and volatility is relatively moderate to low. And then eventually they can stop and then stocks can bottom. None of that has anything to do with VIX 70.
Got it. Well, Ben, it's been fantastic getting a chance to pick your brain. You are truly, I think, one of the people I most talk to on derivatives. So it's been a true honor. People should check you out on Twitter at Ben D. Eifert with two N's. Ben, thank you so much.
All right. Hey, thanks for having me. It was fun.